720 WGN. John Hanson here, starting another week of Your Money Matters. Happy Monday evening, everyone. Here are the numbers that matter. The Dow up a quarter, S&P up a half, the NASDAQ up 1.5 ahead of the big Fed meeting, which starts tomorrow. National gas prices up a penny. It's up 8 cents a gallon per week. Illinois, we're up to $4.41 a gallon, a little cheaper in Wisconsin and Indiana. But if you're driving diesel, up 3 pennies. It's up a quarter in the past week, up to $5.32. No surprise for you. U.S. factory activity grew at a very slow pace, the slowest pace in a year and a half in April, as more workers continue to quit their jobs. And construction in the U.S. barely rose in March, well below expectations. Houses in the Chicago area, experts say, still undervalued by 1%, one of the few areas in the country still labeled undervalued. But around the Midwest, we got homes in Milwaukee overvalued by 20%, and that is pretty much the norm. And that's actually going to be the main question of the day today. I've been looking at this map of where they say that home prices, despite gigantic increases, are still undervalued or overvalued. And the Chicagoland area is one of the most undervalued areas in the country at 1% less than what they feel like homes should be worth. So our question of the day today, and for that you get a 100th anniversary t-shirt here at WGN Radio, is where do housing experts say the most overvalued homes are in the country right now? 312-981-7200. Your guesses for the question of the day, where do housing experts say the most overvalued homes are in the country right now? And I actually was intrigued by this because, you know, I mentioned that Chicago number, that despite the increases in the past year, they still say we're undervalued by a percent. I'm looking at a new Crane Chicago Business article that the price increases of homes, of new homes in the Illinois area, are up $50,000 in the past year because of an increased demand. And of course, we've seen the price of lumber fluctuating and other things as well. But they say that new home prices are off the rails in the Chicago area. Yet nationally, we're not as bad as everybody else. So 312-981-7200 if you've got an answer to the question of the day. But there was an article in the Tribune today. It was an AP article, which piqued my interest. And I'm curious what Lauren, Mary, and Kevin think about this as well. The headline is "Sneakers, Elastic Pants, Back to Office Fashion is Quite Comfortable." And they go on to talk about home, working at home. We're so used to, you know, wearing athleisure. And as offices try and bring people back, they're trying to say, okay, you can wear whatever you want. So yay or nay, Lauren Lapka?
I'm totally not wearing a hoodie as we talk about this.
That's totally not why I called on you first.
No, but it's true. I think, the radio station is pretty laid back, and I've always kind of been a jeans wearer. It's kind of typical wear for, I think, all of us. So that's a little harder to say, but I choose to wear comfortable clothes.
But what about sweats and yoga pants?
Okay, yeah, that would be a little too far. I think that's a bit too much. Yeah. But be comfortable. It makes work a lot easier.
Well, Kevin's wearing his yoga pants, so he's obviously okay with that today.
Always yoga pants to work, John.
Yeah.
Excruciating job. Got to be comfortable, you know? I think it's fine. I think it's more accepted now, dressing that way, really, you know? And like the whole athleisure thing, I guess, is taken, you know, it's not just like... Yeah, it's comfortable, but it's not just like some old gray pair of sweatpants you have stuffed in the closet, right?
Right.
It's got some style to it, I guess.
At least iron the gray sweatpants when you wear.
Mary, it stains out.
You're classy lady, Mary Vandeville. What do you think?
I guess I'm kind of old school. I think people once in a while should dress up and look a little nicer.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I mean, I can see jeans. I wear jeans probably once or twice a week, I think. But, you know, once in a while, a dress is kind of fun, you know? Put a dress on or
not,
you know,
when it's just freezing in this newsroom, which is every day.
Well, that is true. I mean, my studio is a little warm, right? Yeah, the newsroom is always cold.
Yeah.
So poor Lauren, somebody has blankets wrapped around.
Yeah, I actually do have the blanket on my lap as well as this hoodie.
Yeah, we all have sweaters we keep here.
It's an accessory to the yoga pants.
That.
The
so in
blanket.
That case, yeah, you do need a hoodie here and there. But otherwise, once in a while, I think, you know, people should look a little nicer at work sometimes.
I don't know. It's a changing culture. I'm fine with jeans, totally. Yoga pants all the time.
No, not yoga pants.
That's a little
Some people just don't even look good in yoga pants.
Right.
They wear them anyway.
Exactly. We're going to be talking about I-bonds in a moment and how you can get a guaranteed interest of nearly 10%, which you take any investment, I take near 10%. There's, of course, some rules and regulations about who can, how much you can, and how much you can't. But I went ahead and actually purchased one, and I want to walk you through that process in just a moment. But let's get an answer to the question of the day. Let's hope. Homes are soaring in prices, and according to experts, 96% of the country is overvalued. Chicago is not one of those areas. The metropolitan area, one of the few areas that is undervalued, folks say, by 1%. And I wanted to know, can you tell us which is the area in the country that is the most overvalued? Let's go to Lisa. Hey, Lisa, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing great. What's your guess, Lisa?
My guess is Florida.
As I'm looking at this map of undervalued versus overvalued, overvalued is in blue. And there is a lot of blue and purple in Florida. Orlando, 24% overvalued. Palm Bay, 48%. Miami, 30% overvalued. Walton Beach, Destin, that's about 40% overvalued. But it's not the most overvalued area in the country, Lisa. I'm sorry.
Okay, thank you.
That's a great guess, though. Let's go to Jeff. Hey, Jeff.
Hey there.
What's your guess, my friend?
I'm going to change my answer. I'm going to go with the Bay Area, San Francisco.
That's a great guess, but unfortunately, that's not the answer. Only 6% overvalued. Now, they had a big boom a couple years ago, right? And I don't know if that's playing into it, that those are already baked in as the highest values in the country, but it's not the answer. I'm sorry, Jeff.
All right. Thank you.
And let's go to Kevin. Kevin, I think he just stole your answer.
Yeah, so I'll go with Boston.
Okay, good. I was like, I want to give you a chance now. That's why you shouldn't change your answers in the middle of after you talk to the producer. Boston is 14% overvalued. Overvalued, but not the most in the country, Kevin. Thanks for calling.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Let's go to Pat. Pat, last guess here. What are you guessing?
I'm going with Utah.
Utah, pretty overvalued. Salt Lake City at 31%. North of there is 45% overvalued, but not the most overvalued area in the country, Pat. I'm sorry. Thanks for calling, though.
Thank you.
Yeah, have a good one. All right, let's move on here. Let's talk about I-bonds, which, boy, I don't know, that just sounds boring, but it really isn't due to the incredible rate that they are now offering for I-bonds. And Kristen Myers of The Balance joins us now to chat about that, amongst other things. Kristen, it's always great to chat with you.
Hey, John, thanks so much for having me.
I know, like I-bonds. I just am like, okay. But we've been talking about them this year because the I stands for inflation. And this is a variable rate bond that is adjusted every 6 months based on inflation. And the new numbers came out today as they just did their recalibration. And boy, oh boy, it's kind of an eye-popping number.
Yeah, 9.62%. This is actually, just for anyone who's keeping score at home on I-bonds, which I'm sure your audience, there's many, many out there that are keeping track, but this is actually the highest yields that these I-bonds have ever had since the government first introduced them back in the late 90s.
Yeah, and I know that I said eye-popping. Of course, the inflation number is a little eye-popping, and that's exactly what this is. I know a lot of people want to run out and go, man, guaranteed 9%. I don't want to say there's catches, but there's definitely things that would maybe make this better for some people versus others. Right, Kristen?
Yeah, so I wouldn't exactly call them catches,
right,
but really more limitations, right? Because they are, in all honesty, they're very low risk and high inflation environments, which we're in right now. It's a very high return on your investment. I mean, where else can you right now be guaranteed essentially to get back about 10% return on an investment, essentially guaranteed by the government? It's really hard to really find that. But there are, as I mentioned, a couple of limitations. So first and foremost is that interest rate is only locked in for 6 months. The new interest rate came out in May. The second one is going to come out in November. So what this means is, while inflation runs high, you're going to get a nice return. But right now, we do have the Federal Reserve doing everything they can to really bring that inflation down. So there is no guarantee in 6 months, for example, in November, that return will stay as high as it is right now. Mm-hmm. Number two, your money is locked up for 1 year. And even after a year, if you sell those bonds before 5 years, you're actually going to face a penalty of about 3 months' interest. So you are going to have to hold on to this. So this is not the time, if you're cash strapped right now or you don't have too much saved up, for you to go run and dump all of your money in those I bonds. And then another one of those limitations is that you can only buy $10,000 worth. I know I say only because it is a lot of money, but for folks, for example, who are looking to retire soon, they might think, oh, okay, let me get those I bonds right now and really lock in some of those higher yields. But unfortunately, you can only invest up to $10,000. So, I mean, this isn't going to massively pad those retirement portfolios, as you're going to need, obviously, a lot more than $10,000 to to retire. And then I wouldn't call this a limitation, but it's worth mentioning you have to buy it directly from the U.S. government. And I don't know if anyone out there has visited a U.S. government website, but they are not the most user-friendly. They are a little bit clunky. They feel a little bit old school, and that can be frustrating for people.
I felt like it was one of the first websites ever designed when I was using it. It reminded me of when I was at home as a teenager on AOL back in the day and trying to navigate through it. But I will say it was easy to do.
Yeah, it is fairly easy to do. Again, that $10,000 limit, you buy it straight from the Treasury. And I will say, you can buy it for yourself. You can buy them for friends. You can even buy them for children. It is owned, that bond is owned by whomever you register it to. And again, you do have that $10,000 cap. I will say it's $20,000 if you are a married couple. And some people might not know this, John, but you can actually, if you think that it's old school to do it online on that clunky website on the Treasury, online Treasury website, but you can also do it through paper using your tax return. That, mm-hmm. however, has an even lower limit. You can only max out at $5,000 if you try to use those tax returns.
Right, your return back right into it. And, that's $10,000 per person. So if you're married, you can do 20. And if you have businesses, you can do 10 per business is what I was reading too.
Yes. And I will also say, because since we're talking about I-bonds and obviously so many people right now are so interested in ways to essentially beat inflation, there is another form of investment that I feel that we need to also mention. It's called TIPS, Treasury Inflation Protected Securities. Now, they are not the same as I-bonds. They are a little bit different. However, they're also essentially tied to inflation. There are a couple of differences. They don't have the same kind of caps. You can buy them directly from the Treasury, but you can also buy them from a broker. So it is a little bit easier to purchase. And the cap is as high as about $5 million. So you've got a lot more runway to work with there. However, while the interest rate is really locked in on those I bonds for 6 months, it changes every single month when it comes to those TIPS. So it could go higher. It could drop a little bit next month, but you don't have those same kinds of limitations of needing to hold it for a year, can't sell it before 5. So it is another thing to consider, another thing to add to your portfolio.
I'm not someone that should be just willy-nilly giving out financial advice, so take this with a grain of salt, listeners, if you'd like. But if you have your emergency fund set, and that is cash, and you were considering, and you have some money in the market, and you got your 401k where it should be, all that stuff, and you're literally just going to have it sit in a savings account, or you were going to buy a CD, then that's where I feel those I-bonds are good for. You're going to earn a lot more than a CD right now, or way more than a savings account, but you're still going to keep your emergency fund in place. Kristen, that seems to be the pathway, I think, where a lot of people fit.
I think you've been listening very well to me, John, throughout our chat. Honestly, I couldn't have said it better myself. I think that's absolutely correct. If you have a certain amount of money saved up to the side, money that you know that you can rely upon in case of an emergency, and you have spare cash, and again, you don't have to buy as much as $10,000. You can buy as low as $100, $25 even. So if you have some spare cash lying around and you don't need it, for what you think is going to be the next 5 years, but you really want to essentially maximize and help yourself in these times of high inflation. Instead of getting your wallet dinged whenever you go to the store, you want to actually get some return on your investment in this high inflation environment. I-bonds is a great place to essentially park some of your cash. And again, it's very, very low risk. I mean, it's about as low risk as you can get. It is guaranteed by the U.S. government, which means something needs to horribly go wrong with the U.S. economy for you to not be paid out. And if that does happen, we might have some bigger problems than losing some of the money on those I-bonds.
That's ultimately what I said. I was like, you know what? If the bonds are done, we're in a lot of trouble. We're fending for ourselves in many different ways. All right, Kristen, I'm going to put you on hold. Kristen Myers from TheBalance.com. We're going to take a break and then the news. And then we're going to talk about something, since that was I-bonds. Some people think that's boring. We're going to talk juicy stuff. Should you and your spouse split up your expenses? Ooh, we'll talk about that in a bit. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. We'll continue our conversation with Kristen Myers from TheBalance.com in just one moment. We were looking at the most overvalued home prices in the country, and one report shows that 96% of the country is overvalued. Chicago isn't. We are undervalued by a percent, which I know a lot of people who just bought a price of a house way more than they thought they would are shaking their heads and wondering, how is that possible? But I'm asking you for our question of the day for a WGN Radio Retro 100th Anniversary t-shirt. What is the most overvalued area in the country for homes? And we go to John. John, thanks for holding, my friend. How you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good. What is your guess?
Denver.
Denver, Aurora, Lakewood is 35% overvalued, which I can tell you is less than half of overvalued of the number one housing market. I'm sorry, John. Great guess, though. Not the answer.
Okay. Thanks anyway.
Have a good one, John. He held for a long time, and he's wondering, man, got that one wrong. Let's continue our conversation with Kristen Myers from TheBalance.com, which, by the way, if you haven't been to TheBalance.com, I know I say this every time you come on, Kristen, but it is such a well-laid-out site with a money snapshot and just looks so well-organized, and I learn a lot of things from the website. You guys do a great job there, and you're the editor-in-chief, so give yourself a pat on the back, Kristen.
Thank you. I can't take all the credit. I've got a great team that works on all of this.
You sure do. Before we move on, I seem to not want to get off of I-bonds. We had a great text from someone said, so basically you can't lose money on an I-bond. And, you know, it's not one of the bonds where you'd ever see depreciation value. I know that the lowest would be 0%, which is the fixed rate right now. But the lowest, the variable rate would be 0%, even in deflation, unless I've read it incorrectly. So I guess the only way that you would lose money on it would be like kind of what we were talking about, like something, you know, apocalyptic happened to the U.S. government.
Like, and so essentially, you might not lose money, but you might not gain it. And that is a problem if you have to lock up your money for 5 years,
right?
Because you're not going to be able to take that cash and put it into another investment, whether it's different bonds, for example, or stocks, or crypto or NFTs or anything like that that you might want to buy that is going to get you money. So in a way, you actually do end up losing money if you really think about it, because you're not, that money's not being put to work elsewhere.
I see what you're saying. And we should just note that you have to lock it in for a year. From years 1 to 5, if you pull out, you lose the last 3 months of interest. So not a huge penalty, and it's penalty for money you've made. It's not getting you underneath the amount that you initially put in, but that's just the way that one works. Okay, I love your column in The Balance as well, and you had someone write in about moving in together and trying to equal up the rent even if people don't make as much, and it ended up just being a broader conversation about couples and finances. Boy, this must be a sticky conversation for a lot of people.
You know, I do have to plug it. It's a column that I write every single week. It's called My Two Cents. Everyone, if you're out there and you're listening, you can 100% write in. Write me your money questions. I take them all, money problems in families, with loved ones, at work. I'm happy to answer it all. But yes, when it comes to love and money, it is two things that is really difficult, John, to combine. I mean, we still see, at least when it comes to married couples, finances. Still, you know, one of the number one reasons why couples are getting divorced. And it is something that I think people really do need to get on the same page about before they enter into these long-term committed relationships, whether it's marriage or otherwise.
Right. My spouse and I, we call it team money, right? Like the income we make helps the team, but we still have, well, we have a joint savings account, but we still keep our own checking accounts. He has his own business as well, so he's got to do that. He's got to have that cash flow on the side on his own. We kind of keep our own credit cards for now. And at least, you know, we're only 3.5 years in, so maybe people are rolling their eyes at me saying this. But for us, that seems to work, having that sense of, you know, independence still.
And you know what? That actually works for a lot of couples that have been together much longer than 3.5 years. In fact, there's plenty of married couples, actually, that do keep their finances separate. And there is totally nothing wrong with that at all. I mean, you can even file your taxes separately if you wanted to. There is a whole tax column that you're able to check for that. I'm married, but I want to still file my taxes separately. And depending on what your income is, if you have a business, that might actually be the most beneficial thing to you. But combining finances really does mean different things to different people. For some people, that means just having a joint bank account, for example, that you're paying your rent or your mortgage out of, and perhaps, you know, the electric bills. But for other people, combining finances really does mean intertwining absolutely everything from joint credit cards, joint savings account, joint checking account, joint investing accounts, you know, really just 100% putting all of your money in one individual pot. I will say I am always personally leery of doing something like that, but especially if you're not married, just because you don't have the same kind of legal protections if your relationship doesn't work out.
100%. And I guess, Kristen, and we got to wrap it up, that the overarching thing is, look, whatever you decide and it works for a couple, great. Just, like, communicate it out. Make sure that the other person is aware of what that means and what that is. And then you can pretty much work anything out as long as everyone's on the same page and there aren't secret hidden things going on.
Yeah, I think what most of the money issues that comes up between couples isn't because, you know, one person is making more money than another, although that issue does exist. But it really is a lack of communication. One person lying or hiding about things about their finances, committing what is called financial infidelity. That is a thing,
right.
You know, essentially cheating on your spouse financially with what you're doing with money, or just simply not talking openly and honestly and being vulnerable about what your expectations, what your goals are, and what you want out of life, at least when it comes to your finances. So I urge everyone that's out there, even if you, you know, you're not married, but you're thinking about it, or this is someone that you want to maybe move in with or have a very long-term relationship with, start talking about money. I mean, it can be fun. It can be interesting. And honestly, you really might be surprised.
Yeah, for sure. And if you do end up in that financial infidelity, you end up on my other program, Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. It's on Saturday afternoons from 1 to 3. Kristen Myers from TheBalance.com. Thanks for hopping on with us, okay?
Of course.
All right. After traffic, weather, we'll hopefully get an answer to the question of the day and answer the question, should you give your kids a debit or a credit card? And how young? First, a look at weather and traffic. Mary Vandeveld. Really quickly, what are the most overvalued homes in the country? We had a news organization rank them, and Chicago didn't come in too high, but let's get some answers here. What's the most overvalued? Let's go to Lori. Hey, Lori, you're on WGN.
Oh, hey, John. I was thinking Austin, Texas.
Great guess. That's what our producer thought as well. It is overvalued by 41%, but that's not number one. Thanks, Lori, for calling.
Oh, okay. All right. I'll try back. Thank you.
Have a good one. Let's go to Gordon. Hey, Gordon.
Hi, John. How are you?
Good. What's your guess, my friend?
I read 6 months ago that Idaho was number one, and I think it's still there.
And that is correct. Congratulations, Gordon. That is right. Boise, Idaho is number one. You're our winner, okay?
Well, that's great.
All right. You hang on the line, okay?
You bet.
We're going to get him a T-shirt. Congratulations. And I think Dawn and Michael had the guest, too. But unfortunately, Gordon came in first. All right. Let's move on here to talk about kids and debit or credit or prepaid cards. And joining us right now is Joseph Hostetler. He's from Insider. Joseph, thanks for hopping on the line with us today. Oh, let me hit the button. There we go, Joseph. Thanks for coming on.
Okay, thanks for the invite.
No problem. And I turn your mic on. That certainly helps on out. Okay, how early is too early for kids? I guess it's obviously an individual decision, but where do we start seeing parents start considering getting kids a prepaid card or a debit card?
Well, there are some age limits that are exacted upon a lot of the debit and prepaid cards. But the answer for as far as parents considering getting one of these for their kids as soon as possible. A lot of products you can open as soon as 5 years old.
Whoa.
And, go ahead.
No, I was going to say 5 years old. That seems pretty early to me, but I'm not a parent. What are the advantages of doing it that young?
Both the debit and prepaid cards, they help kids to understand, you know, the value of money and the importance and the effectiveness of spending below their means. And just, you know, depending on what product you open, they might even experience the consequences of overspending. And those are just lessons that cannot be ingrained in a child soon enough.
Amen. And I'm all about trying to teach kids as young as you can. I imagine parents just have to kind of figure out what their best options are. And it's this debit card versus prepaid cards. And before we get into those two, just credit cards out of the option? Like, you don't want to give a kid access to the credit even if it's tied to your account? Or is that part of the equation too?
I'm so glad you brought that up, because that is the key here. You should get a credit card for your child as soon as possible. There are a lot of banks like Chase, Capital One City, there's no age limit on an authorized user for a credit card. And you can sign your child up, cut it up into a million pieces, and their credit will adopt your good habits. So once they become 18 and they're able to open a credit card, they have amazing credit. And I wish I knew that when I was a little bit younger. I would have prodded my parents.
You mean like right when they're born? I mean, you could still be in the hospital signing them up and make them an authorized user?
That's right. I have a little daughter that's due in 2 weeks, and I cannot wait to sign her up for a credit card.
I'm not laughing at your intent. I just find that I love that that's what you're looking forward to. You know, it's interesting because when I did a full run of my credit, I was looking and I thought I had been defrauded because I was like, what is this account that opened when I was 8 years old? I mean, they're making all their payments. And then I asked my parents, and of course, they had done that. And that was in the 90s. I was so glad that they had the foresight to do it. So credit cards right away. What about the actual spending of a debit card versus a prepaid card? What are you thinking there?
Yeah, well, they're very similar. I mean, a debit card is linked to a checking account, and a prepaid card is not. It's basically just a card that you can load money onto. And they're both, you know, they're very similar. They work the same way at checkout by immediately depleting the available balance. So there's no borrowing involved like there is with a credit card. So, you know, kids learn real fast that, you know, if they spend too much on vodka one day, they might not have enough for their Marlboros the next day.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good lesson. There's other lessons to be learned there, too, from vodka and Marlboros, but we'll leave that for other folks. What are some of the pros with debit cards? Obviously, that the accounts can kind of grow with them, but as you said, that there's the overdraft fees, but maybe that's part of the whole equation.
I really think it is. I mean, a debit card is more of a glimpse into adulthood for most kids, especially if they're old enough to have a job. And they can receive direct deposit, and they can transfer money into a savings account if they want. And yeah, it might not sound like positive, but if they're subject to overdraft and insufficient fund fees, you know, that can be a lesson so jarring that hopefully it only has to happen once.
As for prepaid cards, I know that there's a lot of tools that parents can have on those to turn them on and off. So maybe it's a determination of how much, you know, that age that a kid is or the maturity level, because you might be able to have a little bit more control with one of those prepaid cards. Am I reading that correctly?
Yes, that's absolutely right. There's a lot of tools available for debit cards as well. But as you say, you, to be able to turn a card on and off, to be able to restrict certain merchants even, you know, all kinds of things that prepaid cards offer that debit cards do not.
Yeah, that's great. Joseph, I wish we had more time, but we don't. So get a credit card the moment your kid is born, and congratulations to you, by the way. We wish you and mom luck. And then as you go through life, prepaid and debit cards are a good option. Joseph, have a good one, okay?
Thanks very much.
All right, let's wrap things up, take a break, then the news, then Blackhawks Live on WGN.